The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading for you from the Reminisce magazine. Getting started today, headline of this story by Ann Shampoo of Norman, Oklahoma writes, Thoughts of Romantic. A romantic candlelit dinner quickly dimmed. Okay, see what you would think about what happened to her and how you would react to this. She writes, in 1951, my new husband Bob and I lived in our first home, a three-room apartment at 701 D Street in San Bernardino, California. One of our wedding gifts had been a Betty Crocker cookbook from a high school friend. How many of those do we remember getting? I think there was one around our house, too. She writes, I hadn't had much experience in cooking, as Mother didn't like to cook and would shoo us out of the kitchen, saying, get out from under my feet. It never occurred to me that I would find cooking interesting, but I did. I read my only cookbook like a novel nearly every day. I spent some time leafing through it, trying to choose what I would cook next. One interesting suggestion was to prepare grilled cheese sandwiches in a waffle iron. I liked the idea and decided to have a very romantic supper ready for Bob when he came home on his break. He worked the evening shift at the post office three blocks away. I set up the card table at the end of the living room, spread a pretty red and white tablecloth over it, and put two red candles in holders. I waited until he arrived, and while he washed up, I lit the candles and turned off the overhead light. The sandwiches were ready in the waffle iron, so I dipped steaming Campbell's tomato soup into shallow bowls and set them on the candle-lit table. Bob stood behind his chair at the table, and I waited for him to slide his arm around my waist, pull me to him, and plant a long, passionate kiss on my lips. Instead, he walked to the light switch, flipped it on, and said, I've never liked eating in the dark. Well, I've been married to my romantic Bob for 54 years, and he's still full of it. So what would happen at your house if you had happened to you? Let's take a trip back in time here to the 60s, and knowing the hippies of the movement and the hippies in the hate. A 1960s trip to San Francisco was an eye-opener for three naive college girls. This is by Nancy Snyder of Sandy, Utah. While attending Arizona State University in 1966, two friends and I were itching to go on to San Francisco, California, for spring break. If we could find a way to get there, we had a place to stay. A notice on a college bulletin board announced that three guys were looking for passengers to split the cost of driving to San Francisco. This was our chance. We signed up. I had $60 for the entire week. I don't think we can get out of town for that today, can we? Once we got to Oakland, we split from the guys and got a rundown hotel room. A patron had been shot in the lobby a week before, but it was all we could afford. After a brief visit to Berkeley, we arrived in San Francisco, where we stayed at a friend's home. We spent the week walking and taking cable cars and trolleys to places like the top of Knob Hill and the famous or infamous Haight-Ashbury District. We saw flower children sitting in the tops of trees in Golden Gate Park, visited Fishman's Wharf, and ate shrimp cocktail. We got a tour of the underground mechanical system when we were the last ones on the last cable car of the night. We were out past midnight and walked back to our friend's house. Insane by today's standards, but we had a wonderful time. At the end of our visit, we met up with the guys and drove home. After paying my share of gas, I arrived back at my dorm with 1 cent. How about that? Nancy Snyder, Sandy, Utah. Good trip. How about taking a back tour on our television viewing? And I'm sure many of you tuned in as we did to watch the Cleavers, who represented the ideal American family. The title of the story is The Bev and Me by Joanne Clayton of Herron, Illinois. My favorite family sitcom when I was growing up was Leave It to Beaver. I'd quickly change out of my school clothes and into my play clothes when I got home so I could watch Leave It to Beaver before heading outside. As an adult, I see the show as an ideal of the mid-20th century suburban family. As a child, I enjoyed watching the antics of the Beaver because he reminded me of myself. I seemed to be in similar situations, both at school and at home. Seeing someone else getting into trouble and having to pay the consequences took a bit of the sting out of all the disciplinary actions my mom used on me to reinforce whatever rules she wanted me to follow. I've seen reruns of all the episodes many times. I'd watch it routinely up to my teenage years. When I got to Johnston Junior High School in Houston, Texas, I became more a fan of Dark Shadows, which also ran on weekdays after school beginning in 1966. So she writes, there was another little title here, but Gail writes, Gail Beauchamp of Red Lodge, Montana, writes, "We love the neat morals the show embraced. At the time, I was dating the man who would become my husband, and we often said, if we had a son, we'd call him Beaver. We did marry, and our 50-something son has been nicknamed the Beaver all these years." A little side note by Ann Hyatt also on the show. She's from Union Grove, Alabama. Ward Cleaver, who was Hugh Beaumont, and June was Barbara Billingsley, hardly ever shouted at their boys, even when they didn't do what they were told. In my favorite episode, The Bank Account, Ward wants Wally, who's Tony Dow, and Beaver, who's Jerry Mathers, to deposit money into their college savings. But instead, they withdrew cash to surprise their dad with a new hunting jacket. Ward is angry before he realizes what they've done. "I guess I jumped to conclusion," he tells them. "I apologize." So Leave It to Beaver, you know, ran from 1957 to 1963. It was first on CBS Network and then later on ABC. And in reruns, seems like forever. Okay. Now, talking about consequences that Ward was instructing his boys there. But here's a story by Sonny Johnson of East Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the coming-of-age section called Actions Have Consequences. He writes, "My mother, Mary Johnson, boarded her 5-gated American saddlebred mare at a barn we rented from a local meatpacking company, or slaughterhouse, in Muskegon Heights, Michigan." Now, I must tell you, if you're a little squeamish, the end of this story gets a little bit interesting. She would walk or drive daily to the barn to clean the stall and feed, groom, and exercise Golden Lassie. That was the horse's name. Sometimes I went along, accompanied by my best friend, Ronnie Friedman. We were 6 years old and had strict instructions to stay away from the packing company. Being city boys, we didn't understand the concept of how animals turned into ground beef or hot dogs we ate. Ronnie and I would help my mother by dropping hay, alfalfa, or straw down from the hayloft. We had so much fun in the loft, lugging bales with our hay hooks to make forts for cowboy and Indian wars. Our task usually lasted 20 minutes or so. Then we were free for a couple of hours to wander the nearby woods. When winter arrived, we headed to the valley west of the slaughterhouse, where we made a wondrous discovery of rubber ice, flexible ice, ice that bounced like rubber when we jumped on it. We had a lot of fun until one day in December 1939, when we both broke through the ice. We were covered in slime, blood, and muck up to our knees. In those days, there were no sewer facilities, and the slaughterhouse refuse channeled down into the valley. What a mess. Because the barn had no running water, we couldn't clean off. Shamefaced, Ronnie and I reported back to Mother in our filthy clothes. Instead of being coddled as we expected, we were made to walk the mile or so all the way home. My parents had a new car, and Mother would not allow two slimy characters like us into her nice green Buick Special. The temperature was 40 degrees that day, but it felt as if it was 40 below. We walked home, whining about my tough mother, but respecting her for her tough love. By John and Sonny Jack Johnson of East Grand Rapids, Michigan. Big lesson in that, isn't it? How about a thing called love? Grammar school sweethearts reunite. This is by Francis Stallworth of Corryton, Tennessee. In 1947, my sister Marion and I were invited to a friend's birthday party. My boyfriend planned to meet me there. He later called to say he couldn't make it. Talk about luck. When I arrived, a young man opened the door. He was the most handsome man I'd seen in my 16 years, with a black crew-cut haircut, a small mustache, and beautiful blue eyes. His name was Tommy. "He's mine," I whispered to Marion. After the party started, we played post office. I was extremely shy, but I cheated and got Tommy's number, 13. Before I could call it, he called my number, 10. I later learned that he had cheated, too. I had never been kissed like that before. I completely forgot my boyfriend's name. When refreshments were served, Tommy offered me a taste of his ice cream. He sat with me and asked if he could take me home. I agreed. I started to introduce him to my parents, but had to ask his last name. The minute he said Stallworth, I realized he had been my sweetheart in the second grade. Back then, our teacher made double rows, and my desk was adjacent to Tommy's. One day, Tommy brought in a small glass lamp and placed it on his desk. He slowly pushed it onto my desk and whispered, "It's yours." Then he kissed me on the cheek and ran into the cloakroom. As soon afterward, I changed schools and lost touch with him, but I thought about him often. Tommy and I waited until I was 18 in 1949 to get married, and we had four daughters and a son. Our wonderful marriage lasted almost 57 years until his death in 2006. What a great love story. Francis Stallworth, Corryton, Tennessee. Here's one from Darlene Black from Montevideo, Minnesota. And this is in the Our Lives section. The title is More Bounce Than Bad Luck. Friday the 13th delivered an unexpected surprise. Friday, September 13, 1935, will always be a most memorable day for me. All was well in my sleepy hometown of Wigdal, Minnesota. That's where I live with my parents, Gustav and Mildred Nineham, and my brother, Ordell Nine, and I was seven, and delighted that Grandmother Baxter was staying for a two-week visit. Around dusk, the adults told my brother and me to go outside and play. This time of the day, we usually were called home, so it seemed odd. But I was having fun with a playmate in her yard, so I paid no mind until I noticed the shiny black car in our driveway. I thought it must be my great aunt Helena from Granite Falls, Minnesota. So I went home to check. I got just inside the door before my father stopped me. Suddenly, I heard my mother scream, and I started to cry. "Is Mama dying?" I asked. "No, no," Dad said to calm me down. The next thing I heard was a cry. I joyously shouted, "Oh, it's a baby!" Soon, we got to see our beautiful newborn baby brother, Paul, who had curly hair with ringlets down the back of his head. As you may have guessed, the car in the driveway wasn't my great-aunt's. It belonged to the doctor. Paul hadn't been a tot too long before my father announced, "He's a boy, and he has to have a haircut." Off to the barber shop they went. That was a sad day for Mother and me, but I'll always consider the Friday the 13th, a wonderfully good luck day. Here's another good story about true love. Title is Blue Skies Ahead, Chalk It Up to Her Big Smile and His Stripes, by Gerald Mullen of Latonia, Ohio. Call it chance. Call it divine providence. Our first meeting occurred in 1950 on 4th Street in Huntingtonburg, Indiana, while I was visiting one of my sisters. I was 15. Two houses down, I noticed a man selling melons from a truck. So I walked over, and there stood a beautiful girl near the truck. I said hello, and she smiled back, but that was about it. At the time, I was too shy to say any more. Fast forward 5 years, and I was home on furlough, proudly displaying my newly earned sergeant's stripes. My brother and I were walking east on Main Street when we passed a young woman walking toward us. I should have recognized that infectious smile, but I didn't. I felt my heart stop and stammered to my brother, "Who's that?" "I thought you knew," he said. "That's Lois King, Bert King's daughter. He's chief of police here." I vaguely remembered that Bert had a daughter and that they lived next door to my sister on 4th Street. Then it hit me like a cannonball. This Lois was a girl with a million-dollar smile who'd left me speechless years ago. Funny what time can do to a person. To put it mildly, we had both changed. I had to return to Ladd Air Force Base near Fairbanks, Alaska, in a few days. When I learned Lois was still in high school and in the same grade as my baby sister, we began writing to each other. I'll declare, you could almost see the blue smoke seeping from those letters. We were married 6 months after my discharge. I am now 83, and Lois and I have been married for 62 years. We have 3 girls and 4 boys. 2 are preachers and 1 a mortician. To put it another way, he writes, 2 to marry him and 1 to bury him. People told us that we were too young and that we'd never stay together. But here we are, propping each other up and reminding ourselves, old age is not for sissies. Thank you, Gerald, for reminding us of that adage. Okay, let's take a look here at work in the Our Lives section. Title is To Build Lightning in a Factory. She delivered the right parts to get the job done. This is by Ethel King Miller of Oceana, California. We were at war in 1942 when I graduated from Burbank High School in California. So instead of going to college, I went to work as an expediter at Lockheed Aircraft Corporation near the airport in Burbank, where P-38 Lightning fighters and other warplanes were assembled. Here's how the job worked. Every morning, I received a list of parts needed on the assembly line. My job was to find the parts and deliver them to where needed. The parts were in either of 2 plants. To get between locations, I rode a bicycle with a large basket. Sometimes the basket was so heavy, someone had to hold the bike as I got on and give me a push to get started. I don't recall how I stopped. If I couldn't find parts, I asked the buyer to order them. I bugged him until the parts came in and got them inspected and delivered them. It was an important job, especially for an 18-year-old. I was my own boss. When I walked through the plants, I heard lots of whistles from the work crew, which I ignored, of course. But once I stopped to give one of the men a big hug. When his fellow workers asked him how he rated such attention, he replied, "I married her sister." The crew member was my brother-in-law, Rex Welker, who soon joined the Navy. I met Lloyd Miller at the plant just before he entered the Air Force. We married when the war was over. While I worked for Lockheed, the company held a competition to find someone to help with public relations photos. There were 38 contestants. I didn't win, but it was still a thrill having my entry picture taken as I stood on the wing of a P-38. Although I usually wore a pantsuit to work, no jeans, I knew when my picture would be taken, so I brought my favorite dress that day to change into. I am now a happy and healthy 92-year-old, and I wonder if any of the other contestants are still alive. And that picture's right here in the magazine with her standing on that airplane near with the cockpit open, and she's got a hand up on the cockpit top there. And she didn't win, but I can see there must have been some other really outstanding girls in that plant then, based on this one for sure. Some facts about the Lockheed's P-38 Lightning Fighter. It remained in production through World War II. Pilots in the German Luftwaffe named the fearsome twin-engine plane the Fork-Tailed Devil. P-38's pilot shot down more Japanese aircraft than any other fighter pilots. More than 10,000 P-38s and 18 distinct models were built during World War II. Our thanks there to Ethel King Miller of Oceana, California. How about some boys in a fishing tail here? This is interesting to see what they're doing here. It says, "Bullheads for the Bullies" by Danny James of Summerfield, Florida. One night in 1954, I'd been out catfishing with my buddies, Gary Calvert, Ralph Witt, and Bob Winters. We were all juniors at Warren Central High School in Marion County, Indiana. With several bullhead catfish in a bucket of water, we were heading home when we came to a stoplight. As we waited for the green, several guys from Franklin, a rival school, pulled up in a convertible and got to heckling us. We weren't looking for trouble, so when the light turned, we drove on. That must have aggravated them, because at the next stoplight, they pulled up beside us again, and this time it started to get out of hand. One of the Franklin guys took off a shoe and was beating it on the roof of my old Ford. So Gary decided to take action. He picked up the bucket with our night's catch, leaned out the window, and emptied all the catfish into the laps of the guys in the back seat of the convertible. Catfish have sharp spines in their pectoral and dorsal fins. If you get stuck by one, it really hurts. So you can imagine the chaos those fish caused in that convertible. You never heard such screams. While they were busy with the slimy catfish and sharp spines, we took the opportunity to flee the scene. We never saw those guys again, but I've often wondered what their parents had to say when they and their convertible rolled home, smelling like dead catfish. I bet they remember that warm summer night as much as we do. That by Danny James of Summerfield, Florida. Okay, here's one. It's called A Last Laugh. A virtuoso and me. The great pianist displays a talent for acting. Sitting at the old upright piano in my bedroom, I'm about to play one of the few simple pieces I have mastered. barely cut above Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. I have my best blue dress on and ribbons in my pigtails, sprawled on the rug, keeping an eye on things, are our Cocker Spaniel Rusty and her black furred son and sidekick Dusty. This is by Ann Simmons of Charleston, South Carolina. It was cocktail hour in 1950 St. Francisville, Louisiana, and several musicians and guests of the board of the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra mingled in our living room. Daddy, highball in hand, leans against the door of my room, smiling with pride. "You can do it, Annie," he says, with his usual fatherly deaf ear to my flaws. His favorite music at the time was Broadway show tunes, judging by the number of times we had to listen to South Pacific on a record player. Whenever I hear snippets of it, I think of him. My mother, whose musical taste is more highfalutin, hovers nearby. Recently, she had taken my brownie troupe to Baton Rouge to see the orchestra, a first for most of my country classmates. One girl from rural Hardwood spotted the cellos and squealed, "Look at all them big guitars, y'all!" Back in my bedroom, I'm cornered. Standing close to me is an elegant Spanish woman in a silk dress. Her raven hair is pulled back in a bun. On her distinguished face is what can only be called a forced smile. She is world-renowned classical pianist Amparo Iturbe, best known for duets with her brother Jose. A few years before, the Iturbes had performed Mozart's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra in E-flat in New York City before a crowd of 12,000. Now, as a visiting performer with orchestra, Amparo Iturbe is our guest, compelled to listen to me. It must be agony for her. A prodigy I'm not, as I rush through the piece, more presto than stately lento, even the dogs shamble out of the room. Fortunately for everyone, but especially for Madame Iturbe, my recital is brief. She claps politely and says, "Brava," and we have both put on a worthy performance by Ann Simmons of Charleston, South Carolina. I'm sure she was a traumatic experience for her, but she remembers some good things about that. I know you may have had some questions or some ideas for stories for the Reminisce magazine, so we encourage you to let us know about that. But it looks like we have run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Bye-bye. Once more, you're mine.